So we come to the last lecture, and this is a lecture to try to assess Machen, maybe try to provide some categories for how to assess him. Was Machen great? And if we wanted to make Machen great again, it would be MM. What would it be? Anyway, one way to assess greatness in American history is to look at standard reference works. American National Biography is one way to do this. It's the standard reference work for biographical entries about notable Americans published by Oxford University Press. And if you wanted to know, okay, did Machen make the cut to be included among notable Americans? He did. Good. That's the good news. He received an article of the length of 1,325 words. So one way to put that in perspective is to compare him to other entries. Well, George Washington, how many words did he get? As the first president, he deserves 8,025 words. How about people closer to Machen's own time? Machen's own time. William Jennings Bryan, who ran for the president three times as a Democratic nominee, received an article worthy of 3,500 words. And H.L. Mencken, a contemporary of Machen, received 2,600 words for his article. So Machen falls significantly short of Washington, obviously, but even of Bryan and Mencken. So this may give you some, or give us some perspective of how editors evaluate someone's significance, how much space they're going to give to them in a book that has to include a lot of people. You have to make choices. If you want to compare Machen then to other religious figures, think about this. For Jonathan Edwards, he received 5,100 words in this reference work on biography. Charles Hodge received almost 3,000 words. Harry Emerson Fosdick received 1,650 words. Benjamin Warfield, 1,525 words. Robert Speer beats Machen by a little bit, 1,375 words. Clarence McCartney, 1,025 words. And Charles Erdman even made the cut. He comes in with 850 words. So maybe one way of evaluating greatness using something like this is to say anything over 5,000 words is great, over 2,500 words is pretty good, and then maybe under 2,500 words is merely good. That may be one way of thinking about it. Another way to think about this, though, is how historians have evaluated Machen. Robert Motes Miller was a biographer of Harry Emerson Fosdick, and he wrote a review of Marsden's book on fundamentalism way back when. That was published in 1980. Miller wrote a review in it, and in that review, he referred to Machen as quite loony. That is not a technical term, but still, that was Miller's impression of Machen after having written a biography of Harry Emerson Fosdick. Ernest Sandin, who wrote one of the most influential early books on fundamentalism called The Roots of Fundamentalism, published in 1970 by the University of Chicago Press. He was also a graduate of Wheaton College. He mentioned Machen with the term phrase that Machen was characterized by perverse obstinacy. So the academic historians won't let you get too far with Machen because he carries this reputation for having been not just but a fighter, but something on the order of an obstinate or perverse fighter. What do Orthodox Presbyterians have to say? And this includes some Orthodox Presbyterians who were also very good academic historians. On the 50th anniversary of Machen's death, Mark Knoll, who was then an elder in the Orthodox Presbyterian Church in Wheaton, observed that the cost of Machen's contentiousness was large. So he also picked up on this fighting side of Machen. Noel goes on that Machen undermined the effectiveness of those Reformed and evangelical individuals who chose to remain at Princeton Seminary within the mission board and in the Northern Presbyterian Church. Noel added that Machen left successors ill-equipped to deal with more practical matters of evangelism, social outreach, and devotional nurture. Again, picking up on the idea that Machen fought so much, he wasn't as interested in those other parts of the work of the church. George Marsden, who grew up in the OPC, spent a lot of his life in the Christian Reformed Church. Once he started teaching at Calvin College then, and eventually finished his career at Notre Dame. But he also observed in a piece written at published by Princeton Seminary, one of its magazines or journals, he attached himself to observe Machen's cantankerousness. So again, picking up on this reputation that Machen had, his propensity to fight. He went on to observe there that Machen's critique of liberalism had merit, but Machen himself had a personality that only his good friends found appealing, and Machen stood for a narrow, old-school confessionalism and exclusivism that many people today find appalling. That's kind of harsh, I have to say. These were impressions of Machen that I valued very much, still value very much the work of Marsden and Noel. It shaped my own career, especially when I was starting out in grad school. I continue to regard them highly, but this was the perception of Machen that I was trying to work with as I was making sense of Machen while studying him in grad school and then writing a biography of him. Outside the historical field, that we have the example of John Frame, many years professor at Westminster, at both Westminsters, and then he wrote a book called Evangelical Reunion, which is partly responsible for Frame's own discomfort with the militancy that characterized Machen and then the OPC. And he eventually wrote an article in 2002 or 2000, maybe even 2000, that was called Machen's Warrior Children. And he echoed Noel and Marsden there when he wrote, "The Machen movement was born in the controversy over liberal theology. I have no doubt that Machen and his colleagues were right to reject this theology and to fight it." Frame added, "It is arguable that once the Machenites found themselves in a true Presbyterian church, they were unable to moderate their martial impulses. Being in a church without liberals to fight, they turned on one another." So they ate each other. And curiously, too, is to think about the introduction to Christianity and Liberalism that Carl Truman wrote when Erdmann's republished it. And there, Truman, maybe he wasn't intentionally trying to do something with this, but he situated Machen in the context of European theological developments, showing how much Machen was a conservative in those sorts of circles, but that's implicitly removing Machen from the American context, and it fails to recognize how much the American context really did inform what Machen was up to. And that's a way of bringing in here a voice that maybe would somewhat be unusual, unexpected to think about Machen. And this writer, whom I'm going to use now, appeal to, Michael Duran, who was in the foreign policy world in the Bush administration. So he's not in any way part of the Presbyterian world. He's not a part of academic history. But he wrote a piece on the political theology of foreign policy for First Things a few years ago. And it was really significant in outlining the major forces going on in the United States, the Protestant churches being part of that, as America is emerging to become a global power after World War I and beyond. And so it may not be the case that Machen recognized everything that was going on in America and in the church. And it's not necessarily the case that the churches were simply responsible for this. It's more often the case that the churches were underwriting America's position in the world, because the churches, at least since 1869 and the reunion of Old and New School, were trying to serve the nation. But Machen was actually reacting to something much bigger than Harry Emerson Fosdick preaching at the Presbyterian Church. And Fosdick himself represented, you could argue, something much bigger than that. So what Michael Doran is trying to do in this is trying to explain two wings of American foreign policy. One of those wings he attaches to Andrew Jackson and the way that Jacksonians looked at America's place in the world. And he looks at William Jennings Bryan as an example of a Jacksonian outlook. And then he contrasts that with a Wilsonian understanding of America's place in the world. And he links that to Protestant foreign missionaries and the way that the churches conducted their affairs in the rest of the world. And this is really quite striking, since, again, the Machen conflict results in a controversy over foreign missions. And what finally costs Machen's place in the mainline church is his establishment of an independent board. It was no threat at all. It was a tiny little operation. It was really no threat, but you could argue that maybe some people in charge wanted to get rid of the squeaky wheel. Maybe they were a little petty. They wanted to pay Machen back in some ways. But still, the idea that Machen was taking on the Protestant missions establishment and what that might mean for America's place in the world and American foreign policy, America moving from a republic to an empire, the way old Rome did, ancient Rome, could be significant. So here is how Doran tries to explain this. And he links the missionary Wilsonian impulse to progressivism. Progressivism in theology, progressivism in politics. He writes, in matters of theology, progressivism follows a post-millennial view of end times, which teaches that the spread of the gospel will produce a millennium prior to Christ's return. During this period, peace and prosperity will reign throughout the world. In sharp contrast to dispensational premillennialism, postmillennialism downplays the brokenness of man. It highlights instead man's perfectible nature and his ability to improve his situation through his own agency or through government agencies. And then he goes on to write about Protestant modernist theology, what Machen was opposing in Christianity and liberalism. Protestant modernism shifted the focus from personal piety to collective action. It thus became the natural religious home for social reform initiatives. The trend culminated in the social gospel movement of the early 20th century. Walter Rauschenbusch, its leading figure, depicted the historical Jesus as a social activist, an ethicist who eschewed dogma. Deeds, not creeds, might have been Rauschenbusch's slogan. The elimination of social injustice through education, aid to the poor, and government restraint of capitalist excesses, these were now the highest callings of the Christian. The traditional focus of the church on saving individual souls became secondary. The primary goal of Christian life was eliminating human suffering. This task required breaking down the barriers to separate man from his fellow man. Religiously minded progressives defined eliminating divisions among Protestant denominations as the first step to this goal, hence ecumenism, hence the plan for organic union of 1920. He doesn't mention that here, but he could have. Doran goes on, before long, their vision became universal in scope, and they began working to dissolve the barriers among Christians, Jews, Muslims, Buddhists, and pagans. This project continued with gusto as the religiously minded fell by the wayside. As society secularized, the progressive persuasion promoted equality between the sexes and among America's racial and socioeconomic groups. Then he goes on to bring up what this meant for Protestant foreign missions. And of course, when he's talking about removing the differences between Christians, Muslims, Jews, Hindus, etc., he's channeling, and you could well imagine him going to the Hocking Report, Rethinking Missions, the Layman's Committee of 1932, which is exactly what he did. But before he gets there, he also says this: progressivism emphasizes universal human brotherhood, which it believes is within the capacity of humans to achieve. As a result, the progressive persuasion tends to emphasize peacemaking more than vigilant self-defense. Fighters aren't that good for progressives. One pole of the progressive spectrum is an idealistic pacifism. The other pole can be very militant, for it accords the United States an exceptional mission in the world. This mission, however, is not Andrew Jackson's notion of keeping the flame of liberty alive. The mission of America is, rather, in the progressive view, to use its military and economic power to nudge the world toward universal brotherhood. So this is something that had been happening in America since the 1880s. The churches had been a part of this movement. You could argue that the fundamentalist controversy was an effort or an objection by some people to stop it. This was going too far, and Machen was rising up trying to stop it. It almost, you could argue, that a figure like William Jennings Bryan with the Scope trial may have been a Trump-like figure trying to stop this kind of development, the way the Obama years were leading in a certain direction and Trump rose up. But Duran goes on to talk about what happened specifically after World War I. After that time, John D. Rockefeller Jr., leaving behind the orthodoxy of his parents, played a major role in developing this new ideology of activist exceptionalism. He focuses on one particular episode. In 1930, Rockefeller established a commission to study the foreign mission work of seven Protestant denominations. The commission's report, officially entitled Rethinking Missions, is commonly known as the Hocking Report, after the leader of the commission, William Ernest Hocking, a Harvard professor of philosophy. The Hocking Report calls on Christian missionaries to cease proselytizing. Jesus, it argues, is not the sole path to the knowledge of God. Christianity is the fullest expression of truth, yes, but the other great religions also express elements of it. The job of Christian missionaries, therefore, is to identify the Christian-like elements in other religions and to cultivate them with an eye to forging alliances across religious divides. The key to this coalition building is deeds, not creeds. The missionary goal should be to promote activities, education, healthcare, assistance to the poor, that non-Christians can join while remaining faithful to their own traditions. In short, the primary duty of the Christian missionary should be to apply the social gospel internationally. One more paragraph from Duran, which I think is really quite significant for putting Machen in his place, as it were, as far as assessing him. The Hocking Report calls on Christian Americans to drop their theological triumphalism. Human enlightenment, it claims, will come instead by way of the immediate strengthening of several of the present religions of Asia, Christian and non-Christian together. The Hocking Report seeks the creation of a global ecumenical religious culture that will pave the way to universal brotherhood. It is, in essence, a foreign policy manifesto for the Protestant modernist movement, but it is also much more. Rockefeller was laying the groundwork for the moral justification of American global hegemony. He believed that the fundamentalist beliefs championed by men like William Jennings Bryan could not provide the basis for American global leadership because they would alienate non-Christian nations. Moreover, national self-interest is unchristian. So what you have here is the plan of organic union is going to eliminate the differences among Protestants in America so that you can have this brotherhood in America. But now through missionaries, you're going to have a one world kind of religions cooperating together in order to, again, allow peace and harmony to prevail, but also to allow America to be the leader of this new world order, as it were. So Machen, in fighting liberalism, was fighting much more, again, than simply some deviations from the Westminster Confession of Faith and Catechisms, or much more than Harry Emerson Fosdick. He was fighting, whether he knew it or not, whether he understood it or not, he was fighting this bigger movement of progressivism, both in American politics, foreign policy, and also in the churches. I think that's a really important way for trying to understand Machen and his contribution and why his fighting may have been as prolific, extensive as it was, and why that cantankerousness, to use that word, might have been more a virtue than it was a liability. Because these were serious matters, not merely in compromising the gospel, which is the most serious thing for him, but also for what's happening in America and the rest of the world. And we continue, this at this point in American history, to continue to try to figure out America's place in the world and what America's responsibilities should or should not be. So, thinking about legacy then, of Machen, in conclusion, one way of thinking about this is to say, where was Christianity and liberalism going? Where was it heading? What was its telos or endpoint? And this is one way of trying to figure out where people get off the Machen bandwagon, as it were. Most people recognize Christianity and liberalism made some sound points. Secularism is a problem. Liberalism of a kind of accommodating secularism may be a problem. But then you can just leave it at that. Let's just stop there. So, for PCUSA evangelicals, generally speaking, these are the ones who stop after 1923. Christian liberalism is a great contribution. Machen was well within his rights to do that, but that's it. You made your critique. Now, continue to work at Princeton. We're not going to send our students to Westminster to study with you. Then there are second point, the PCUSA conservatives. This would be people like Samuel Craig, Clarence McCartney, maybe. They look at 1929, the founding of Westminster, as another stage of opposing liberalism, quite consistent with Christianity and liberalism. And it's a good thing, but they draw the line there. We shouldn't go more than that. Westminster Seminary is a good agency to have working within the PCUSA, trying to reform the church from within that way. Then you have Reformed evangelicals, say someone like John Frame, who would go with Machen all the way to 1936. The OPC, okay, it's pretty good. Machen needed to do that. The trial, independent board, whatever you make of the independent board, those are worthwhile activities, needed to form a new church. But then, after 1936, the OPC gets hijacked by Machen's warrior children. And then one more example might be to say the Orthodox Presbyterians of the Orthodox Presbyterian Church. Here I'm thinking perhaps of someone like Charlie Dennison, who go with Machen all the way to 1986, the 50th anniversary of the OPC, and they celebrate Machen's history. They celebrate the history of the OPC. And they also say we should not join the PCA. This was at a time when they were debating whether to join and be received by the PCA. The OPC had enough votes to do it, but not the supermajority needed. I mean, they had a majority of votes, but not the supermajority of votes to do it. And Charlie Dennison was someone who was trying to recover the history of the OPC and use that recovery of history to instruct Orthodox Presbyterians about what their proper place was within the Protestant world, what the mission was. So Machen's legacy then is fighting, but another way of talking about that is to say reformed militancy. Fighting for Machen was good, even if it was unpleasant. And people, I think, would say today, concede, fighting a virus was good, even if it was unpleasant. Fighting Russians is good, even if it's unpleasant. So fighting can be okay. But Machen was very much interested in preserving a place for controversy in the church, not because inherently controversy is good, but inherently because there's going to be something wrong. There's something on the internet that's wrong. That's why I'm up at 12 in the morning typing. You've seen that cartoon. Well, Machen always thought something could go wrong, so you need to be on the lookout. And he wrote this about this in 1931 about the task of Christian scholarship. Men tell us that instead of engaging in controversy about doctrine, we ought to seek the power of the living Holy Spirit. A few years ago, we had in America a celebration of the anniversary of Pentecost. At that time, our Presbyterian Church was engaged in a conflict, the gist of which concerned the question of the truth of the Bible. Was the church going to insist, or was it not going to insist, that its ministers should believe that the Bible is true? At that time of decision, and almost it seemed as though to evade the issue, many sermons were preached on the subject of the Holy Spirit. Do you think that those sermons, if they really were preached in that way, were approved by him with whom they dealt? I fear no, my friends. A man can hardly receive the power of the Holy Spirit if he seeks to evade the question whether the blessed book that the Spirit has given us is true or false. Again, men tell us that our preaching should be positive and not negative, that we can preach the truth without attacking error. But if we follow that advice, we shall have to close our Bible and desert its teachings. The New Testament is a polemic book almost from beginning to end. Some years ago, I was in the company of teachers of the Bible in the colleges and other educational institutions of America. One of the most eminent theological professors in the country made an address. In it, he admitted that there are unfortunate controversies about doctrine in the epistles of Paul. But, said he in effect, the real essence of Paul's teaching is found in the hymn to Christian love in the 13th chapter of 1 Corinthians, or 1 Corinthians, as it might be. And we can avoid controversy today if we will only devote the chief attention to that inspiring hymn. In reply, I am bound to say that the example was singularly ill-chosen. That hymn to Christian love is in the midst of a great polemic passage. It would never have been written if Paul had been opposed to controversy with error in the church. It was because his soul was so stirred within him by a wrong use of the spiritual gifts that he was able to write that glorious hymn. So it is always in the church. Every real great Christian utterance, it may almost be said, is born in controversy. It is when men have felt compelled to take a stand against error that they have risen to the really great heights in the celebration of truth. So that's a big part of Machen's legacy, is Reformed militancy and his recognition that it really is necessary for the work of the church. One last part of his legacy is also the idea that isn't the Reformed faith grand, which is, I think, something he wrote on one of his last telegrams to John Murray. I think that's the case, but again, I may be a little shoddy in memory, but it was one of the last things he said in his life. And so I'm going to quote here from, in conclusion, what he had to say about the Reformed faith being grand, and this is from his statement about the attack upon Princeton Seminary, an article he wrote in 1927. As over against such a reduced Christianity, we at Princeton stand for the full glorious gospel of divine grace that God has given us in his word and that is summarized in the Confession of Faith of our church. We cannot agree with those who say that although they are members of the Presbyterian Church, they have not the slightest zeal to have the Presbyterian Church extended through the length and breadth of the world. As for us, we hold the faith of the Presbyterian Church, the great Reformed faith that is said in the Westminster Confession to be true, and holding it to be true, we hold that it is intended for the whole world. But it would be the greatest mistake to think that the issue with regard to Princeton Seminary stops there. It would be the greatest mistake to suppose that the difference concerns merely the question whether we are to stand for the full heritage of our Reformed faith or are to content ourselves with some lesser creed. Though the difference cuts even deeper than that, it concerns not merely the question as to the content of the doctrine that we are to set forth, but rather the attitude that is to be assumed with regard to all doctrine as such. It concerns not merely the question whether we are to teach this or that, but the question whether what we teach, we are to teach with our whole hearts and in clear-cut opposition to the drift of the times. So Machen was concerned with the Reformed faith. It was grand, and it was worth fighting for.